You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hello, and welcome to SpyCast from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Mark Stout, historian of the museum. I'm a PhD author and historian who served for 13 years as an analyst in the U.S. intelligence community. Every month, the museum brings you interesting talks with authors, scholars, and practitioners who have something to do with the world of intelligence and espionage.
I'm speaking today with Morten Storm, who's joining us via Skype from Europe. Morten is originally from Denmark, was a convert to Islam who fell into Al-Qaeda circles, and then through a personal journey, which we'll talk about a little bit, came to be working with Danish, British, and American intelligence, providing information on Al-Qaeda, among other things involved in tracking down Anwar al-Awlaki. So that's the subject of our conversation today. And Morten Storm, welcome to the International Spy Museum.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's absolutely a pleasure.
Morten, can you tell us a little bit about your background before you became a Muslim, and because you were a convert, and before you became associated with the Al-Qaeda world?
I'm from a small town, small province in Denmark called Korsør. it's about an hour from the capital, Copenhagen. I was a young boy, always seeking some kind of adventures in my life. I was not really satisfied with having that the normal school, and so I was like always searching for some more exciting things, alternative education and sports. During my teenager years, I fell into like gangs and youth, you know, where you hang out with the wrong guys. In my later stage, as a young adult. I joined up with a motorcycle gang called Bandidos. So,
and how did you? How did it happen that you converted to Islam? When did that happen?
Well, it happened in 97 when we were in the middle of the biker war between Bandidos and Hells Angels.
And about how old would you have been at the time?
I was 21 when I made my indefinite choice to convert to Islam.
Okay, go ahead.
Doing that, we stayed for 2 years. I participated 2 years in the biker war between Hells Angels and Bandidos in the Scandinavian biker war. And, I was fed up of life, and I knew it was not the right path. I then decided to maybe look into religions. And that's where I went secretly, without telling my friends, to library in my town. It's a public library, and I read... I picked up a few books about other religions, but Islam was the was what actually attracted me. And I read the biography of Prophet Muhammad, and that book actually guided me to Islam. It made me choose the decision. And then I would then go a couple of times to the mosque, which I felt quite, I felt so happy about it. I felt like released and purified from all the bad stuff I used to do in the week. Later on, there was actually the same day as Mike Tyson boxed against Holyfield, where, you know, Mike Tyson bit his ear. That was the day I got arrested and put in custody. They put me in remand for 10 days, doing an investigation, and later on found out I was not guilty of what they accused me of. But in that period, I decided I'm going to be a Muslim now, and I will definitely change my life and move on because I saw the life I lived in was not the right path for me. And Islam gave me some answers, gave me some hope, which it does really. It's totalitarian religion, which means everything is written down for you. You don't the way you use the toilet, the way you eat, the way you greet people. So everything is comprehensive here.
It provides a lot of answers.
A lot of answers, and that's I think what I was looking for. And at the same time, it also provides a brotherhood, a family for you. And once you embrace Islam, once you convert to Islam, you are now a member of a family of 1.6 billion Muslims, you know, around the world. So it gave you some kind of identity as well.
Now,
and security. Yeah.
You were not initially a radical, somebody who associated with terrorists. How did that evolution happen that you started to fall into more and more radical circles? I understand that early on, fairly early on, you met people who later became very well known, like Zacharias Moussaoui, the so-called 20th hijacker, Richard Reed, the shoe bomber. I assume these weren't the first Muslims you met. How did you get into that world?
You see, Mark, the first stage is that people embrace Islam. That's the first, you know, you declare your faith is when you convert to Islam. After you've done that, you learn how to pray. You learn the pillars, the five pillars of Islam and the six pillars of faith. It's called Al-Iman. And once you learn this, you start to move on. What happened to me, I was just a normal guy, happy to have found a new religion, happy to pray and, you know, find the answer of all my questions. I then later on moved to UK, the United Kingdom. I lived there for a little while and for about 2 months. Before I moved to Yemen. I traveled to Yemen in 97 and studied Islam over there, in the north of Yemen, in Saada. It's also a place, a camp called Ad-Damaj. Damaj was a very known place for Salafis. Basically, the Salafis are quite a fundamentalistic branch within the Sunni Islam. I studied there for about 9 months in Yemen, and during that time, I built up a huge network. Also, due to my nature of the background where I come from a biker background, from boxing and all that. So we had a lot of common with other converts that I met from America, from Sweden, from all over Europe and even Indonesia and all those places. There was a lot of things in common with us. There was training, boxing. There was some of them were quite criminal backgrounds from America. A lot of those converts were ex-convicts, you know. So there were a lot of stuff to talk about. And amongst that topic was jihad, you know. Jihad is a part of Islam. Which is actually the most noble act that you can commit within Islam is if you do perform jihad, it's the most rewarded if you want to be guaranteed paradise. So jihad became a part of our topics, but not the main drive yet. That came later on.
Now in this, go ahead.
Yeah, see that came later on. What the main drive was actually to learn about the faith, to become more certain and more convinced that Islam was the truth, and any questions you had will be answered through the Hadith or the Quran or, you know, and so forth. And also you could ask the scholars, so everything made sense.
Now, in the summer of 2001, I understand you almost went to Afghanistan, this being the summer just before September 11th and then the American invasion of Afghanistan.
Yeah.
What happened?
You see, in 99, just before the new year of 2000, Russia invaded Chechnya again, Grozny. During that time, that's when I met Zakaria Moussaoui. I met Richard Reed, the shoe bomber. We were praying in the same mosque in Brixton, in London. And that's it's a Salafi mosque. So we were quite frustrated that during this invasion that our imam in the local mosque, our sheikh, the one who prayed with us, or lead the prayer in the Ramadan, did not supplicate or pray for our brothers in Chechnya. It quite made people question if that branch we were on was the correct path, because jihad, as it's prescribed in the Quran, and the commands of practicing jihad and doing making jihad against the infidels once you've been invited is very clear in Islam, and that's what we saw, that there was something wrong. Zakaria Moussaoui was very upset about people not praying for them. And I used to come and visit him with my with our mutual friends in his flat in London. But anyway, then we moved into 2000. I went back to Denmark. I served some time for the last time. I had something outstanding with the Danish government. I had a fight with three guys. I got 6 months for it. So I had to go back and do that sentence. When I came out, just before 9/11, I decided to move on to Yemen to study more Islam, and I just got married to my Moroccan wife at that time, the mother of my three children. Basically, because of my network in Yemen before from the previous day, I was now connected to the right people, and one of them was the courier of Osama bin Laden. The other ones were people who traveled regularly between Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Yemen. So, and some of them asked me if I was interested to travel to Afghanistan and meet Osama bin Laden. I said yes. So his personal messenger went to Afghanistan and spoke to Osama bin Laden and also had, I got the personal invitation of him. But that was about 2 months before 9/11. At that time there was no issues with 9/11, Islamic terrorists, or so there wasn't a big issue. In fact, many Muslims who are non-terrorists or who do not support Al-Qaeda have been to Afghanistan and in this very same training camps. So, and without being under the radars or without being in troubles with the governments. At that time, it wasn't an issue. It was only after 9/11.
So you were invited, but you didn't actually go to Afghanistan. No. Why didn't you go?
I didn't go because that Osama wanted me to take my family, bring my family with me. My wife at that time was pregnant with my firstborn son. So she's pregnant. She was pregnant at that time. And I told the messenger, I said, listen, I can't join you guys. If I have to bring my wife, I need her to stay in Yemen, and then I will travel first and see how the country is. But they wanted me to migrate, to make hijra. It's called hijra when you migrate, and that was what he needed from me. So I refused, obviously, and after I had a reply from them saying, well, if you're not bringing your family, you can't come.
So you came back to Europe in 2002. Did you find that Al-Qaeda had a strong presence in the United Kingdom, in Denmark? So we're after 9/11 now, and Al-Qaeda is on the front page of all the newspapers. Were they a strong presence in Europe when you came back?
Well, there was a lot of supporters. There was those who were actively supporting by collecting money or propagating it, the jihad against America. That was obviously propagated in the mosque and private houses and gatherings. In fact, I have to tell you, Mark, that many Muslims did not see the invasion of Afghanistan to be a war against Al-Qaeda. They saw it as being an invasion against Islam. So, and the same happened in 2003 when you invaded Iraq. There was also an attack on Islam. So basically, most of the Muslims in Europe were supporting Al-Qaeda. Not because that they hit the towers in Twin Towers or Pentagon. No, for the simple fact that our Muslim country had been invaded, i.e. we need to support our Muslim brothers and sisters. So that's why in general, the support was for Al-Qaeda and like-minded people.
Now, sometime during this period, you had your first contact with British intelligence, MI5. The domestic British intelligence service. How did that happen?
Well, that happened first time in 2005.
Okay.
Yeah. But that happened when I used to hang out with this group called, at that time, called Al Muhajirun. That group was leaded by, Omar Bakri. He's also known as the Ayatollah of Tottenham. Omar Bakri is currently living in Lebanon, in Tripoli. I became at that time what you call a radical Muslim. I don't use that term. I use it as fundamentalistic Muslim. I became more practicing. I started to practice more with a red, in the textual, in the religious books. And we used to be in this group called Al Muhajirun, which was very known and infamous in the United Kingdom. Umar Bakri would encourage us to go for demonstrations, anti-American demonstrations, or interrupt elections, local elections, where we lived in Luton or London. And I was at that time also appointed to be the guy in charge of training for the group, for all the young guys. So we will have like military training, boxing training up in the hills. In UK, we will have our lectures, weekly lectures. And yeah, so I became more and more radicalized or practicing Muslim at that time.
Is that why MI5 came to see you?
Yeah, I had a knock one day on my door and MI5 turned up. Basically, what they were offering me, to cooperate with them, to work for them, and I declined that because I did not believe that you, as a Muslim, can help the disbelievers against your own brothers, even though they might be wrong, but it's a matter of loyalty within the creed in Islam.
Now, when did you first meet Anwar al-Awlaki, an American Islamic scholar who later became very famous as a senior member of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula? You came to know him sometime during this period, I believe. How
yes.
did that happen?
I met Anwar in the beginning of 2006, in January, I think. Late January 2006, I met Anwar al-Awlaki. And we became friends. I met him in his house, in his father's house in Sana'a. And I met him I was invited for a lunch, for a meal. Well, to eat lunch, you know, that's the main meal in Yemen is the lunchtime. So I met Anwar and his son was there, Abdurrahman, the one who also later on got killed, unfortunately. But so I met Anwar there with a lot of radical Muslims.
What kind of man was Anwar al-Awlaki?
He was very cheerful. He was a very open person. He was very honest. He will not lie to you. He will tell you exactly the way he looked at the world, and he will tell you his opinions based on the Quranic verses or hadith and so forth. He was a devoted family father, a husband as well, and a father. I saw that, and I know as a fact that he was quite relaxed and lean with his wives. But the other personality was also that he was a man with some plans. Those plans was to establish the Islamic State in Yemen, beginning in Abyan.
Now, you had already at this point turned down one approach from British intelligence. And sometime in here, you're also contacted then by the Danish intelligence service, PET. How did that happen, and what did they want from you?
Well, that happened. That happened about a year later, or maybe a little bit less than a year. But it happened after I was in, as you know, I was in Yemen. I was in quite a lot of contact with Anwar. We were in contact with the people in Somalia at that time. The Islamic courts, the Islamic Union courts, were trying to establish Islamic Emirates in Somalia, and they were trying to fight Abdullahi Yusuf at that time, the current president over there. So we were always in touch, and that obviously created a lot of intention from the American government, from the Western governments as well. And I was studying in Al Iman University, which was Islamic university owned by Sheikh Al-Sindani, Abdul Majid Al-Sindani. This man, he was very known and wanted by the Americans. During my stay in Yemen, I spent time with, I studied with Mustafa Anwar Jihad. He's an American national now wanted on the FBI most wanted list, your terrorist list. He's in Somalia now. Anyway, a group, when I traveled to Denmark, I got married in Yemen. My second marriage in Yemen, and I had to travel to Denmark to work. I worked with a bricklayer, a friend of mine who had a company who built houses. And he offered me a job so I could save some money and then move on to Somalia, where they were trying to establish the Islamic State. So I left my wife and kids in Yemen, traveled to Denmark for a couple of months, worked there, and then discovered that most of my friends in Yemen were arrested. Apparently they were accused of creating a small Al-Qaeda cell in Yemen and then sending weapons to Somalia. Some of it were true, but I wasn't a part of that. I could have said that now if it was. I wasn't. Yes, they were my associates, but I was not a part of what that group had planned. They all got arrested. I went to the Danish TV media because of my connection with some journalists and put a lot of pressure on the Danish government to try to solve the problem with those guys. And it resulted in all of them being released with no charges.
And the Danish service contacted you while you were in Denmark for these couple of months?
Yeah, I had a phone call one day, and the guys said, are you Murat Storm? That was my Muslim name. I said, yes, I am. They say, my name is Klang. I cannot tell you his name now. My name is Klang. I'm from the Danish intelligence. Could we meet? I told him, I don't know who you are. Why should I meet with you? You just get my, how do you get my number? He said, that's very easy for us to get your number. And he suggested we should meet in a hotel to have a little chat. I told him, no, I think maybe you're from the CIA or you could be Mossad. I said, I suggest you come to the mosque and meet me there. So we were not actually trying to find any terms between us or like agreements where we could meet up. But I went back to the mosque and told everyone that I had this approach. And they say, they thought that it would be a good idea for me to speak to the intelligence, but make an appointment at the local police station in case they were not CIA, and, you know, to prove that they're not trying to kidnap you or send you to Guantanamo. So, I was... it happened that I met the guys in the Danish in Aarhus. It's like the second capital of Denmark. We met the Danish PET there, and we had a chat about, you know, political views. And obviously, they say we're very concerned about you and your contacts and your network. First, they tried to recruit me as well, and I again declined that because I was a practicing Muslim. You can't ally yourself with the disbelievers. In the Quran, it's very clearly states that whoever who allies with them is amongst them. So, which would mean that I would be apostate if I allied or helped the disbelievers. I told the guys, listen, I want to go to Somalia. I have no intention of making any terrorism anyway. I mean, my family were all Christians. Why should I kill them? I mean, so... but I was definitely willing to go to Somalia to fight against the current government there.
And you, in fact, tried to go to Somalia, but you failed. And that was a major turning point in your life. Can you tell me about that?
Well, it was probably the biggest blow to my faith ever. I was so keen on going to Somalia because jihad, as I just said before, is the highest. There is nothing in Islam higher than jihad. And whoever dies as a martyr, you go straight to paradise with no account. You know, you will never be held account to any of your bad deeds. So obviously for every Muslim, that is the highest achievement, to die as a martyr and fighting for the sake of Islam, for the sake of Allah. So on my way, I had most of my friends. One of them was this American Jihad Mustafa, who's now wanted in America. But one of they all traveled to Somalia. They were all engaged in the fighting against the Ethiopians and also the at that time that current government ruled by Abdullahi Yusuf. So for me, I went to Copenhagen to buy a lot of army equipment, like clothes and water purification systems, you know, like backpacks and all that, rucksacks. And then I spent a lot of money there. I collected money. I was prepared myself mentally as well to leave. I said goodbye to all my family, my friends in Denmark, and my wife and kids, and never expect to return. I think a day on my way back from Copenhagen, that was about 1 or 2 days before I had to travel to Mogadishu. I had a phone call from Mogadishu saying, "Murad, we just lost the airport to the Ethiopians. You can't come. You have to cancel your trip. You'll be in trouble." So I was so devastated. I was so devastated not being able to travel there that I went home with all my shopping gear, for all my gear that I bought in that army store. I went home and looked into the laptop and on Google and just typed contradictions in the Quran.
Contradictions in the Quran.
Yeah, yeah. And I found a website. I don't know why I did it. It was just like, I guess I was asking why I have to be stopped. Why are you stopping me to performing what is most noble in your eyes? I was talking to Allah and myself, you know, why is it that I'm being prevented to do this good deed? And then search the contradictions. To my big surprise, I saw a lot of contradictions. I saw a website, I think it's called answeringislam.org. I went into that and found hundreds and hundreds of contradictions. And, you know, as a Muslim, you cannot question the Quran. You cannot question Allah. I mean, if you do that, it's called hidden disbelief or hidden hypocrisy. Yeah? It's called as a nifaq al-batniyya, like hidden hypocrisy, which is one of the nullifiers of your faith. And I started to search to research some of the contradictions to see maybe that website was more biased, and, you know, because maybe they had a Christian agendas to spread Christianity. And then, but anyway, I searched the contradictions and looked up the references in the Quran and the Hadith, and, you know, they were all right. They were actually all true, you know, and it just wiped away my faith.
So this led to you meeting again with PET, with the Danish Intelligence Service, and really changing your life again.
I called them.
Go ahead.
I told his name is Klan. I told him, "Klan, it's Murad Storm, and I would like to meet you guys in the hotel now, no longer in the police station." So they said, "All right." They were really so excited. I said, "I need to tell you something." So we met up in the Radisson Hotel in Aarhus. We met up there, and I remember when we sat in this king suite, president suite room, they trying to impress me with the menus and, you know, like being very nice to me. You know, the good, sometimes you have the good and the bad cup, but in my situation, I only had the good and the good cup. There's only, both of them were very nice. But at the same time, they were very curious of why I would ask them to meet up. So they were like, they didn't know how to handle me. I saw that. And then one of them, he said, "Let's have some food." And he took out the menu card and said, "Murad, would you like to eat?" He called me my Muslim name out of respect, not to insult me. That's how much they respected me, even though my real name is Morten Storm, even in Denmark. But they say, "Murad, would you like to eat something? We have fish on the menu. There's vegetarian food, because it's non-halal, you know." I say, "You know what, guys? I want something with bacon and pig in it. Yeah, I want bacon, and then I want a beer." And then they looked at me. They looked at each other. They were not sure if I made a joke. I said, "Guys, listen, I want something with bacon and then I want a beer." I told them, "Please, I'm no longer Muslim. That's why I came to tell you." And they were like, high five. And I said, "Listen, guys, I'm ready to fight this ideology. I'm ready to fight these people. If we can prevent terrorism, let's do it. Let's go for it." And we were high-fiving, hugging each other. It was like, they couldn't believe it. They were so joyful. And for me, I remember this like yesterday. And I tell you what, one thing, I might have this fallout in some disagreement with the Danish intelligence, but at the end of the day, we have achieved so much. I mean, I remember Klang, he told me that time, the same night, he said, "Murad, this is going to be the biggest, this is going to be so big," he told me. And we never imagined it to become that big as it is now.
Well, what did Danish intelligence ask you to do now that you'd agreed to cooperate with them?
Yes, the Danish intelligence didn't really ask me to do much because they gave me more freedom to do whatever I like. However, they tested me. They gave me a phone. I knew that was bugged. They sent me to a couple of guys in Denmark to find out about them. They probably worked for them to find out if I was truthful or not, if I could, you know, be loyal. What they didn't understand was that I was loyal because I was convinced that what I did was the correct thing to do, morally, for anyone. And I was not politically motivated, nor was I motivated by any religion. My motivation was to stop terrorism. That was the only thing I did.
Now, our listeners will want to know, so please forgive me for asking, were they paying you money as well?
They were paying me just a little bit because we agreed just to cover the cost of my bills. That was my most concern. I wasn't there for the money, Mark, because it was for me something I believed in. I became high on doing the job because I loved it. Yeah.
Now, PET arranged meetings then with British intelligence, MI5 and MI6, and I believe later with the CIA as well. How did all of that happen?
The first meeting I had with the MI5 and 6 was my return from Lebanon in 2007. I went to Lebanon to Tripoli to visit Omar Bakri, the leader of Muhajirun. During my stay in Lebanon, I met also with Fateh al-Islam. Fateh al-Islam was, you know, the terrorist organization who launched the attack against the Lebanese government in 2007. The war lasted for about 3 months, and I had about 1,000 people killed. I was with those guys.
And if I can interrupt, presumably you provided information about those things back to Danish intelligence.
I did, actually. Once I spent time, I drove around in Tripoli with two suicide bombers, Saddam al-Hajjib and his driver. It was quite disturbing to sit in a car with two suicide bombers. Well, they had the explosive vest on. And then they told me, you know, they're trying to establish the Islamic State in Lebanon, in Nahr Barit refugee camp. And that was my first international mission. I was very sure that I had some good information and requested to meet the Danish in London. We met in Hyde Park, in Hyde Park in London, in the Churchill Hotel. And at that time, when I came back, I told them, hey, I've been with Fateh al-Islam, and, you know, they're saying they're going to start a war soon, probably within very few weeks. They say, well, we had some people here if you want to meet them from the MI5 and MI6. And we agreed. I said, yeah, just let me see them. And that was my first meeting with the MI5 and 6. I obviously told them, I predicted the war will happen in Lebanon, and they were like a bit skeptical about it because at that time, Lebanon was quite stable. Nobody expected a war there, but it happened. I told them about it would happen from 1 month to 3 months, and it happened about 8 weeks later or something. So,
you also went on some training with MI6. Why, and what were they training you to do?
Yeah, I was trained. In the beginning, I was trained by MI5.
Okay.
In counter and anti-surveillance. I was trained at different various places in UK. I was trained in Fort Moncton by the MI6. Fort Moncton is in Portsmouth. It's the MI6 training center. I was trained in role plays, and I was trained in survival training up in Inverness, and, you know, different places. It was quite interesting stuff.
When did you first meet officers from the CIA?
I met them the same year, in 2007, in Copenhagen, and also in Radisson. No, it's a SAS hotel in Copenhagen. And I met, apparently, what I've been told, her name was Amanda. She was the one who later was killed in Khust in Afghanistan.
I think she's publicly known now as Jennifer Matthews, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah, I met with two guys from first. I had my normal meetings with the PET in Copenhagen. They told me, "Well, we have our counterparts, colleagues from America. Would you like to meet with them?" And I said, "Yes, why not?" I met already with the British, so why couldn't I meet with the Americans? And Amanda and Josh, he called himself, came to see me there. And well, they were quite interested in what. With Anwar as well, and even that cell I was with in Yemen and Lebanon, my Lebanon trip. So, but it was like a casual meeting in the beginning, and then later on became more regular.
And what did the CIA want from you? I know that they became interested in Awlaki. Was that their main focus from the beginning, or
no? It wasn't the main focus, but he was an American national, and obviously I spent time with him. They were not asking a lot of stuff about him. I did tell them that this guy, he will become quite radical in the future. But the most concern for them at that time was, I think they were very interested in Lebanon, and they were interested in Somalia as well. And just generally to know about the people I knew in Yemen, just to build up, so they had like an understanding of my network. I then later on met Amanda and Joshua again in Amsterdam.
And at some point, though, American intelligence, the CIA, did ask you to help track down Awlaki.
Yes, it was. But, you know, before that, we were quite busy in Somalia to send equipment down there because of Saleh Nabhan. He was the one who blew up the American embassies in 98 in East Africa. So we were working quite intensive on that to deliver equipment to get him stopped. And that happened successfully in 2010.
Okay. Turning, though, to Awlaki, what sort of information did they want about Awlaki? How did they want you to help track down Awlaki?
See, the more and more Awlaki got his freedom in Yemen, the more he felt safe after being released from prison, the more he talked. In 2008, I established the first contact from my house, well, from my mobile phone, between Anwar al-Awlaki and his name is Abdul Qadir Wasami, who's now in prison in New York. That was the first establishment between Al-Shabaab and AQAP. And that happened in because of my work there. Anwar was very keen of getting a worldwide network, obviously with the intent of to establish jihad in Yemen. That was the main goal for him. Later on, he changed and became more radical. Well, became more not extreme, but became more angry with America, he was so focused on maybe having revenge on the American soil by killing innocent people. And I found out about this, and I was quite sad that he will do this, because when you meet Anwar, when you sit with him, you do not see a person who is willing to take an innocent person's life, but he was, and that was the most disturbing thing in him. And not only that, he was that good at convincing people that, you know, the guy he needs to be warned against. So I started to warn the Americans about him and say, you know, I think we have an issue with this guy. And only until 2009 that they were not really interested in him, until Abdul Muttalib, the underpan bomb, started to do something. And that was actually first when the Americans started to become more interested in him.
Did it? So you had come to know Awlaki pretty well. I mean, perhaps it would be fair to say knew him as a friend. Did it bother you that as time went on that you were providing information about this man with whom you had a friendly relationship to the CIA, that in some sense, forgive me, you were betraying Awlaki?
That's right. It was difficult. But at the same time, I was no longer Murad. I was Morten. I didn't believe in what I used to believe when I knew him. And had he known that I was not a Muslim, he would have done his best to kill me or had me killed. So at the end of the days, I did it because of work. I did it because I needed to find out about this guy and to infiltrate that organization in Yemen. It is hard because you do develop you know, relationships, good personal relationship with the people. The hardest thing is that when you know the families, as for Anwar, that's his path, he's chosen it himself. As for his children, as for his wives, you know what, it's quite hard for them. And that's what actually hurts me.
So, at one point, Awlaki asked you to help him get another wife. Can you tell that story? You were successful, in fact.
Yeah, that was my last trip. I met him physically in Yemen, and that was just before Abdul Muttalib. At that time, Abdul Muttalib was actually preparing his underpants in Yemen. So, but anyway, I met with Anwar, and we had a, he told me how to use the Mujahideen secret, this encrypted system that Al-Qaeda is using to communicate amongst themselves. He told me how to use it and obviously requested some money from the West and asked for me to arrange the brothers from the West to do training and then to return back to Europe. So that's when I knew that Anwar is intending to target civilian soft targets. At the same time, it just slipped out from him. And, you know, if you know any sisters in the West who's willing to or want to get married and make hijrah, migrate, I'm very interested in them. And he obviously he preferred white, so a white convert. And to my big luck, and to all of our luck in the West and the whole world, is that later on, I think it was December, I managed to get approached. Well, I managed to find Amina.
Who I believe did go on to marry him, didn't she?
That's right. She went in 2010 and married him.
Now, this led to a big cash payment for you.
It did. It did, but the money was, you know, as I said, it was some kind of curse as well, because, you know, it's okay, it's fun to be paid that money, but in the end of the day, it's blood money, you know, like there's blood in them. You
so
know?
Let's be clear, this was not money from Awlaki, this was money from the intelligence service.
That was money from the American intelligence, from CIA. That was paid in a suitcase to me in Copenhagen.
And what was the combination on the suitcase lock?
Well, his name is George, the one who handed over the suitcase. He told me, "Morten, guess," he said, guess the combination." I told him, "I don't know. How would I know?" He said, "Try 007." And I did, and, you know, both it clicked and it opened up and, you know, I had a suitcase full of dollars. It was quite shocking, you know, but a good feeling, you know, it was a good feeling. So I'm not going to complain about it.
So during this period, you're working with the CIA to provide information about Awlaki, but the British service, the MI6, was not very happy about this. Am I right?
Yeah, you see, from the time of 2009, when Amina and I, we start to communicate together, Amina is the woman who became his wife. And when we started to communicate, the British was a bit upset because, first of all, Anwar, he was an American national. So it would have been automatically a CIA project. Not only that, it would also lead to the killing of Anwar because now Obama have issued death sentence to him. The British several times tried to convince me not to work with the Americans by saying, you know, they give me a team building trip to the ICE hotel in Sweden. When the Americans found out about that, they say, well, let us give you a team building course as well. So they sent us to Reykjavik up in Iceland. Yeah. So that was like a clash between the British and Americans regarding who I was supposed to work with or not. The Brits say, well, don't work with the Americans because, you know, they will cheat you one day. And the British say, we do not involve ourselves in the killings, you know, of civilian targets, so we have to pull out. If you decide to work with the Americans, we are pulling out from this.
Did MI6, in fact, stop working with you?
Yes, they did. They pulled out in 2010.
Now, in 2011, the CIA came up with a new plan to use you to get Awlaki. What was that, and did it work?
It worked, yeah. Well, between the time I've been paid my money, the $250,000, the CIA decided to pull out and to do their own hunt of Anwar. It wasn't successful because, first of all, our mission with Amina to get her down there with a suitcase with tracking device in or other objects with tracking device in, it was a failure because when she arrived into Yemen, Anwar told her to only bring with her what could be in two plastic bags. And that was against all of our expectations. We were quite shocked, all of us. We didn't know that. So what happened was the CIA was quite upset about it and decided to go their own way. And I was okay with that because at that time I needed a break. So I was in East Africa working on Somalis over there to build up a more network after Sahil and Abraham had been killed. We were actually just focusing on East Africa and also to build up my undercover company, Storm Bushcraft and Storm Outdoors, to make like a more better excuse for me to work and operate different places and be able to travel around. I had a message a few months later asking me to come back to Denmark and have a meeting. The Americans wanted to see me. So we returned back to Denmark, me and the Danish intelligence, and I was asked if, because they lost the track of Anwar in 2011, they asked me, could you help us tracking him, help us to find him again and establish contact? I said, yeah, I don't mind. And I did that over a couple of months. Even to the last, what I did, I created contact via some of Anwar's associates in Aden, in Abyan. His name is Adil Abab. He's the religious leader of AQAP, or Ansar al-Sharia. He's dead now. He just got killed this year. Anyway, I had sent I sent a USB stick with a new message saying, Anwar, brother, I'm here in Yemen, and please let us communicate over using this messenger. So that's what we did. We used messengers between us, and obviously I bought four USB sticks that I gave to the CIA so they could modify them or do whatever they... I don't know what they have done. That's only CIA who knows that. Anyway, it was so keen that... and so intense that they say that, Obama is, actually following this mission, and it is so important. We need to get this guy stopped as soon as possible. I stayed in Yemen for a few times. I had meetings in Spain with the CIA and the Danish intelligence. We had some equipment. Anwar sent me a shopping list for his wife, and we tried to find out how we can modify some of that shopping list and so forth. It was only about 3 weeks. What happened my last trip in Yemen was that I established, Anwar asked me to find out about the attack that New York Times wrote about, this Racine, the poison attack, and he asked me if I could find out about any information and send it to him. So that's when we knew that Anwar was, it was so close for them to succeed in a poison attack or a mass, what would you call a mass murder attack in the US. So it had to be stopped. This guy had to be stopped by any means. I was in Yemen and had to travel to Borneo in Malaysia for a trip. I was part of my undercover company and I was traveling with a friend of mine. I told the guys, I have to go to Malaysia, but I will leave the last message, the last flash stick, a USB stick. I'm going to leave it with a very close associate of mine who also knew Anwar. By that, you can monitor when this money means that young courier is going to come pick up the USB stick, and you can track him this way. So I didn't know that he was going to get killed a few weeks later. It was
Al-Awlaki was in fact killed on September 30th, I believe, in 2011 in a U.S. drone strike. Yeah. And you had gotten the CIA very close to Al-Awlaki, but the CIA didn't give you credit for this, despite the fact, I guess, there was an enormous reward out for Al-Awlaki's head. What happened?
You see, I was promised $5 million, but that was not CIA who promised me that. I have to be very clear and I have to be very just in this matter, because many newspapers said CIA promised me $5 million. No. It was the Danish government who promised me $5 million for helping the Americans to track Anwar down.
And you never got that money?
I never got paid that money. CIA And I'll tell you why later. I will tell you that why I think it didn't happen. First of all, we know from a Western intelligence officer, the 2nd of October 2011, made a public statement to the Sunday Telegraph about how they tracked down Anwar al-Awlaki. And they mentioned the young courier who was picked up like 3 weeks before his killing, his death. They forced him to cooperate with him. With the CIA and helped them to track him down. So basically, yes, it was not my final words who helped the CIA, but it was my work who helped the CIA to get him. Obviously, I staged the courier. It was confirmed that he came to pick up the USB stick. My associate in Yemen even told me I have the messages in down to dates. So it was very clear that it was my mission and my work. But you see, Mark, the problem is that Denmark, the Danish intelligence, have involved themselves in activities which was against the Danish constitution, the Danish law. So there was no way that they could give me the credit for it. There was no way you could pay me that money for the death of Anwar. That would have, if that happened, it would have been a liability, that money. It would have been a proof that, you know, the Danish government have been involved in killing civilian targets abroad, and that's illegal, which also means that Jakob Scharf, the head of Danish intelligence, would have been sacked, or most of the people who've been involved in this job would all have been sacked. So obviously I understand the Americans protecting their colleagues by saying, you know what, Morten, it was a parallel mission, it wasn't you. Even though we know it's very clear that it was my work. And you know what, I understand why they did it, because they want to protect each other. That's what they do. I was just very disappointed that they were able to do it. I mean, I have put my life in risk several times to track down Anwar, you know. So, you know, and I have spent the 250,000 on the cover company in Africa, and just to work, you know, for the intelligence. I've done a lot of things, you know, took a lot of initiatives for myself and spent a lot of resources and time on it. And then suddenly it just, you standing there with no job because I have managed to get the prime target, and then suddenly I have no job.
So you recorded your last meeting with your CIA case officer and you went public.
I did. See, the recording was not really intended to be for any newspapers. My recording was so I can sit down with the Danish intelligence and show them what Michael said from the CIA. And I was so hurt because when I had the meeting with the CIA, the Danish intelligence was actually turning their back to me. They didn't want to sit in the same meeting. And I went up and I had a meeting with Michael. Michael was a new agent. I never met him before. And he had to explain to me all kinds of stuff that he didn't know about. And you know what? That recording came to my benefit. You know, the benefit was that I could prove that I had been part of this mission. And he even admitted that I played the highest role. But it wasn't me who kicked the ball in. So, you know.
Well, when all is said and done, two final questions. When all is said and done, are you afraid of retribution from Al-Qaeda?
I know as a fact that they are planning to kill me. But you know what? I'm able to take that risk. Don't forget that by me going public, I'm sending a strong message to Al-Qaeda saying that, hey, I infiltrated you guys, so all the plans that we've been talking about, the missions, and, you know, actually we bombed them back to the Stone Age. They will never be able to trust anyone amongst themselves. I mean, I was one of the most highest respected and trusted people, person within that organization, with these people. And if I infiltrated them, who else would? I'm a white dude. Imagine their own Arab guys. I mean, there's no way they will trust each other. So, in that sense, it's okay. It was the risk, but it wasn't the reason why. There was one of the reasons, but the other reason was also that I felt my life was in danger, but not from the Al-Qaeda. It was in danger from the intelligence because one of their own agents have told me my life was in danger. Yeah.
Who do you think among the intelligence services might pose a threat to you?
Well, I went to China to speak to one of CIA's own agents, and that was in 2012, actually in May. I went to China, and their own agent warned me not to return back to Yemen again because there was plans of having me assassinated. And you know what? I don't know if that is true. I can't verify it, but me as just a normal person, and I have just been working for this with good intentions. I didn't have any bad intentions, even against our own intelligence. So I thought it's time to call it off, you know.
Last question. If you had it to do all over again, would you still cooperate with Western intelligence against Al-Qaeda?
Of course I would. I mean, I have to say that from amongst all the people I met in the intelligence services, whether it be the Danish or the British or Americans, I have only met very, very good people. They are all of them, with no exceptions, are very dedicated people. They're loyal to the governments. They are very good at what they're doing. The only regret I have is that I didn't finish my mission last year and I've been able to track down Nasser Wahishi, Abu Basir in Yemen, and also Ibrahim al-Asiri. That really, really bothers me. But besides that, I think I owe a big gratitude to our governments. They might have cheated me for my money, but you know what? It's not the end of the world. We have stopped a lot of people being killed. So that's fine.
That must be a good feeling right there.
Of course it's good. And you know, my mom in Denmark, she was, she haven't even read my book. And I asked her, Mom, have you read my book? You know, Storm, the Danish Al-Qaeda, the Danish agent in Al-Qaeda. I said, Mom, have you read my book? She said, no, I couldn't because I feel bad. I feel guilty that I didn't give you a good upbringing. That's why you became what you are now. I told her, Mom, think about it. I wouldn't change for $1 million because I have been able to save civilian people. I saved their lives. I've infiltrated Al-Qaeda. I have helped Americans and the Western governments to put people in prison who have bad intentions or even had them killed, you know. So I am very proud of what you have done to me. So, so that's quite good for me. I'm happy about this.
Well, Morten Storm, thank you so much for sharing this very personal and fascinating story with us. There's not a lot of people who have had the experiences in the life you've had, so I appreciate you letting us all have a look at your experience and your career.
Thank you so much, Mark, and thank you for the Washington Spy Museum.
We look forward to continuing this dialogue with you, and we'd like to know if you have any comments or questions on today's SpyCast. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum.org. Thank you, and we'll see you next month.